You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a set of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, Collected Works, Volume 157a, six lectures, entitled Spiritual Life Now and After Death, translated by Pauline Verla and Johanna Collis, revised. This is lecture three, entitled The Subconscious Strata of the Soul Life, given on November 20th, 1915. Those days when we have been able to meet together, we have devoted to throwing light, from one point of view or another, on the connection between the life of human beings, here on the physical plane, and the life we lead, between death and rebirth, as well as on the connection between the individual successive earthly lives through which human beings pass. We have seen that when the attempt is made to go deeper into these relations, the investigation becomes very complicated. But in reality, only then does it become fruitful for us, for it can then give many conclusions concerning the details of the mysteries and questions of life. We wish to go further into these considerations. In order to do this, we must today begin by penetrating a little into the structure of the human being, with which we are already acquainted, but that we must go over once again with reference to certain qualities necessary for the following considerations. From the various cycles, lectures, and books, you have seen that we live here on Earth, as human beings, in a specific epoch of the Earth's evolution. Through the whole spirit of our consideration, we have been able to ascertain that there is an inner purpose or inner significance in the fact that we carry our souls through all these various epochs of the Earth's evolution. From the descriptions that have been given, you will already have seen that not merely the external life, but the whole life of the human being here on Earth is naturally different in the various epochs. We shall, for the present, only consider the life of the soul. The life of the soul was different if we consider only the post-Atlantean epochs, during the ancient Indian, Persian, Egypto-Chaldean, or Greco-Roman ages. It is again different in our own time. We carried our souls through all those epochs, and in all of them our souls sought bodies, most of us more than once in the same epoch, that gave them the possibility of taking up the world in the way best adapted to the forces of that particular age. If you recall what has been said about the peculiarities of soul life in the various epochs, you will be able to gain an even more accurate insight. For example, when we consider the life of the first post-Atlantean epoch, we find that the human soul, during its life on Earth, was then chiefly occupied in working out the interaction of its own being with the etheric body. Thus, as it were, experiencing in the right manner what can be experienced here in the earthly life by a soul interacting chiefly with the etheric body. Then, in the second post-Atlantean period, the soul went through everything that can be experienced through the interchange with the astral body. In the third post-Atlantean epoch of civilization, the soul lived through everything that can be experienced through interaction with the sentient soul. In the fourth epoch of civilization, it experienced the interaction with the rational or intellectual soul. And we, in our time, go through everything that can be experienced by means of the interaction with the consciousness or spiritual soul. The soul, according to its experience, while working in the different epochs on the various principles of human nature, makes a greater or lesser individual progress in the general development of the world. Human beings have completely different experiences during these different epochs. As regards the relation of their soul to the entire cosmos, they change absolutely. We must already have some idea of this from what has previously been said. Thus we, in our epoch, are living in the conscious or spiritual soul, and the whole civilization of our fifth epoch is devoted to teaching the whole human soul, the entire human capital I, to form such connections with the world as are possible with the self-conscious soul. In our epoch, we gain our experience through adapting our forces to the conscious or spiritual soul. Now, it is possible to look at the whole matter from another point of view. By what means does it come about in the general cosmic relations that one lives in the conscious or spirit soul? As a human being, one naturally lives not only in the spiritual soul, but also in the other principles of human nature. In a narrower sense, in our age, we build chiefly those capacities that humanity is at present acquiring by our life in the spiritual soul, for through the medium of that principle we live in our I, in the physical life between birth and death. Greeks in the fourth post-Atlantean period were not so entirely dependent on their physical body as we are. They lived still more of an inner life in the body. This caused them to work in the rational or intellectual or mind-soul, and thus they were in a position to fill out their physical body in quite a different manner than is possible for us. Each movement of the hand, for instance, produced a much stronger inner feeling in the Greek than in the body of today. Conventional science cannot enter these things, but they exist nevertheless. When they bent their arm, the Greeks felt the swelling of each single muscle. They felt the angle it formed. That is why the Greek sculptors were in a position to create quite differently. The present-day sculptors work from a model. They behold the model and work accordingly. Not so the Greeks. They had an inner feeling of the form of the arm, of the physiognomy, etc. And this to them was inner experience. But human beings, when they live in the consciousness soul, are now torn out of what can be experienced in the physical body. They have, as it were, penetrated more deeply into their physical body. They have become more closely united with it than the Greeks could be. But they have, through this, become insensible to all that the physical body gives. They make use of the organs of the physical body in a higher sense than did the Greeks. The Greeks could not see certain shades of color as we see them today, because they were not so much within the physical body as we are today. If you reread Homer, you will be able to notice that he mentions few colors. Everything is changed in the same way. People ally themselves more closely with their physical bodies, but they do not experience their own inner being as much in the physical body. Rather, one must say, that instead of perceiving their inner being in the physical body, they contact the outer world more. In other words, there is a struggle for the capacities of the physical body, whereas in Greece there was a struggle for form instead. Thus we can say that we build up the consciousness soul as we bring about a certain inner relationship with our physical body through our I, because we work our way so deeply into the physical body. In this way, the time has come when we no longer know much about spiritual processes and such. It is the time of materialism, because humans have urged themselves so deeply into their physicality. Now, within the physical body, there naturally lies the etheric body. The Greeks still knew much more of their etheric body. They dimly perceived, even though only as a reminiscence, that the etheric body always echoes the movements of the physical body. They still felt that it is not merely the physical hand that moves, but that the etheric hand moves with it and lies at the basis of the physical movement. All this is now forgotten. But humans, while they lived in the Greek age, so experienced it all that they felt themselves much more intensely in this etheric body than they do now, and that knowledge is not utterly lost. As soul beings, we have all gone through it, and it remains in our etheric body. It all remains there as preserved thoughts. And when we leave the world in which we dwell between death and rebirth, we leave behind, as if forgotten, everything that we were previously very well able to dominate in our etheric body. We now thrust ourselves so deeply into our physical body that we leave behind all we acquired in the Grecian epoch. From this you see that our etheric body really contains much more than we now realize. At present we evolve our consciousness chiefly within our physical body, and in so doing we cover up what is in our etheric body. If we only possessed all the knowledge of the inner human organization concealed in the etheric body, we could know infinitely more than we do now. For this etheric body has acquired a certain perfection, greater than humanity is at present aware of. In regard to it especially, much is driven back because it cannot be brought to consciousness in a suitable manner. We know very little of our etheric body. Among other things, in the etheric body, the astral body, as you know, is also at work there. Everything that the etheric body accomplishes must naturally be thought of as permeated by the astral body. If we could suddenly bring to the surface all that the etheric body contains, we should be infinitely cleverer than we are at the present epoch, in which we have to struggle on with nothing but the physical body. For this etheric body contains much. Naturally, the astral body also shares in this. It contains infinite treasures of wisdom. These lie in the depths of our soul, within the etheric body. There we find a host of dexterities, a mass of information. For instance, in reference to geometry, I have once before mentioned how much we all unconsciously know of geometry. This is actually a fact. For when we learn geometry, we do not learn it from outside things. It is reached by bringing what is in the etheric body to consciousness. If we draw external figures, they merely serve as an inducement. If I draw a triangle, of which I know that the angles equal 180 degrees, I know this through the etheric body. We only draw figures in consequence of human laziness. In reality, we know everything that can be learned of geometry. We know it unconsciously. It rests below in the depths of the unconscious soul life. We have no idea how clever we are in the subconscious depths of the soul. Could we but know it? The evil in human evolution does not lie in human beings having little wisdom within themselves, but in their powerlessness to extract that wisdom out of their own soul. All educational development consists of bringing out the concealed wisdom lying in the depths of the soul. Now, if we were not obliged to bring up these things in this difficult way, we could not properly advance our evolution. Just think. If we were not to acquire such a relation to our physical body as we now have, we should really be born as terribly clever children, and it would not take much to bring out, at a relatively early age, what lies within the etheric body. But people would then take far too little trouble to acquire wisdom, and it would thereby be too little their own. They would be too much a mere copy of wisdom. A personal assimilation arises through our having such a relation to the physical body as is ordained for this fifth epoch of culture. This personal assimilation causes knowledge to become our very own possession. When we delve for it in this fashion, our knowledge is then our own. We have it for ourselves. This holds good in reference to the etheric body. With reference to the astral body, something quite different holds good, and that is as follows. If we were able to draw forth everything lying in the astral body, everything that the astral body knows, in all its details, that would be of no advantage for our present life. For we should then really live with others as automatons. Indeed, our astral body knows, though our consciousness does not, the relation in which, as astral body, it stands to all the individual persons it contacts in life. Our astral body has such a consciousness. So that if we could make use of everything the astral body knows, we should be absolutely aware that, for instance, with this or that person, we shall have trouble. And this person or the other will be a kind friend. Such knowledge would naturally change life utterly, but for our present earthly relations, not in a good sense. Now, I could relate still more concerning what the astral body knows, parenthesis, and unconsciously it does already use its knowledge, close parenthesis, but it is a knowledge that really is very little noticed in the connections of human life. Suppose a person dies in an accident. In ordinary human life, it appears to us as if the accident had overtaken the individual, because, according to our present consciousness, people do not seek an accident. However, if we investigate the astral body, we will find no single accident that a person, in so far as he or she is in the astral body, has not sought. What is necessary for ordinary consciousness is sought by the astral body out of a free inner choice. It is thus willed, actually willed, by the astral body. Even if a man is run over by a railway train, that is brought about by the astral body, with regard to the whole connections of his life. It is not something that merely happens by accident. Thus we not only have our connection with our fellow humans as wisdom in our astral body, but in reality, our connection also with the entire outer life, with what runs its course as a natural events or other social happenings in which we are implicated. It is good that all this is purposely hidden from us. Otherwise, we should learn nothing for our further evolution. But there exists in the astral body a true thought, I mean, a kind of knowledge of everything, which shows our connection with the events and human elements in which we are involved. People take little heed of this in ordinary life. For when anything happens to us, we say, quote, "This has just occurred," close quote, and, as a rule, that is the only thing observed. We do not really consider what would have happened if that particular event had not occurred. I will bring forward a striking instance. At a particular time in his life, a man is wounded. In ordinary life, one merely thinks, yes, he has been wounded, and that ends the matter. What would have happened if he had not been wounded? To this, one pays no attention. But through a wound, the whole life may be altered. Everything that follows may be different. Now the astral body beholds the entire connection before the wounding of the man. One may say the astral body is clairvoyant. And the true eye, which rests still deeper in the subconscious and dwells in the inner depths of our being, is much more clairvoyant still. As you already know, we built up our physical body on old Saturn, our etheric body on the Sun, and our astral body on the old Moon. Our I is the baby among the human principles. It is the youngest. Not till the Vulcan period, after the Jupiter and Venus evolutions are completed, will the I be formed, as the physical body is fashioned now. But this I rests the whole time in the bosom of the spiritual world. Then, during the Vulcan epoch, an inconceivable knowledge of the connections of life will stream out of the I. But this knowledge is already now within us, and the evolution on Jupiter and Venus will consist in drawing out the capacity for using it. Thus, while we regard these depths of the soul life, these depths of the soul's life, we see in a wonderful manner our connection with the spiritual world. We, in ordinary human life, are only given what we are able to receive, because the I is reflected in the physical body. But behind this rests a widely extended earthly knowledge, which is in the etheric body. Behind this, again, rests a clairvoyant knowledge that is already in the astral body, and a still more clairvoyant knowledge that is in the true I. It is good to place these things before the mind, before going on to what I now have to say. Let us consider the case that at the present time is speaking so deeply to the soul in such manifold ways, of a man who in early youth is led through the gates of death from the battlefield. It then happens that the principles of human nature, lying more deeply, the etheric and astral bodies and I, are torn out from connection with the physical body in a way quite different from what happens when we grow old and die slowly in bed. A faster separation from the physical body often takes place. Parenthesis, I have already spoken of the prophetic nature of the etheric body. Close parenthesis. We have said that even in dreams, if we could in a sense interpret the pictures we see, we would know that in our etheric body, through the dream that arises, because the astral body turns to the etheric body, which then receives as a reflection what the astral body is experiencing, in those pictures there is something that indicates our future life, something of a prophetic nature. Now, for the spiritual investigator who has to investigate those things, an important question arises out of such considerations. He has first to place this question before himself, and the posing of the question is then a kind of introduction to the answer that must then arise from the clairvoyant observation. For example, one must say, here on earth, according to the normal course of life, human beings are destined to reach old age and to use up their life slowly. To this end, the etheric body, astral body, and I are adjusted. This would occur if the course of life were normal. But now, through a shell that suddenly strikes a person, the whole connection is disturbed. Through this, a certain faculty of the etheric body, I will for the present limit our consideration to the individual person, that force that would have been able to work, as if prophetically, through the entire life, which would have been able to lead this person through many other relations in life, that force is torn out of life. It is separated from the physical plane. Just suppose that the shell had not struck the man. We can put this hypothesis and not consider the fact that all this is, of course, karmic. Well, he would then have gradually used up that force in his etheric body, perhaps during many years. That force is, nevertheless, in the inner part of his soul. It does not cease to exist, and it may be perceived when the man who has been killed by a shell gazes on his life tableau, looks back in the etheric body. I have already indicated that this life picture has a quite special characteristic. It has the characteristic of seeming to come from the outer world, rather than of having to be produced from within. In short, that energy, that force, which is then cut off, remains in the man. Observation reveals the fact that the force is there and transforms the entire life following death. It is just the same with the force in the astral body. This too would have been used during the whole life. This also is still there. In short, people go in quite a different way through the gates of death if they are violently torn out of physical life. If they have perhaps been struck by a shell and lose their life in that manner, it is not the same as if they die slowly in bed. Now, for the spiritual investigator, there arises a great question. What is the actual significance of this? What does it mean for our epoch when a man, as in the case quoted, really brings something quite different into the spiritual world from what he would have brought if he had lived his life out? For such an epoch as the one in which we live, this question is of infinite importance, for much of what has just been described is being carried up into the spiritual world. What does this signify for the spiritual world? This is a tremendously significant question. When one studies a little about the relation of the spiritual world to the physical world, as one can in the Vienna cycle titled Inner Nature of Man and Life Between Death and Rebirth, something becomes important that for a long time has not been believed, but that reveals itself clearly to spiritual investigation. It is the following. In reality, all our conceptions and ideas change on entering the spiritual world, not only on entering the spiritual world through initiation, but also on entering it through the gates of death. You see, here on earth, human beings really evolve more and more in a definite direction. One might call it that of the so-called concept of being. And today people are already greatly taken with this idea of the concept of being. What do I really mean by this? Nowadays, hardly anything is regarded as having value unless it is conceived as actually existing. When anyone comes who does not speak of something palpable, he or she is considered a dreamer. People go around speaking about reality, in quotes, and how, compared to this, mere thought is nothing. Countless people do not value thought today because they cannot take hold of it. Existence means the forcible realization of what is perceived. One has nothing to do with bringing about the existence of a thing. Its existence is obvious. And anything that cannot be proved to exist in this way is considered by humanity with ever decreasing regard. In the evolution of the spiritual world, the reverse is the case. There, what exists and makes an impression, such as a physical object, is for individuals in the spiritual world something inimical, something disturbing, something that they know pertains to the, in quotes, nothingness, and that it is destined to disappear into nothing. And if one enters without further ado into a spiritual region in which there are perhaps rather undeveloped souls, souls who to the spiritual world are just as simple as many souls appear to be in the earthly world, then one finds the opposite opinion prevailing even there. Anything to which these dead souls attach value should not exist, as one speaks of existence here on the earth. Existence here, as such, is of no value to these souls. In the spiritual life, it really is the case that one confronts pure spiritual beings. They affect one. But one must first acquire perception for them. It is thus one stands in the spiritual world. Behind one stand souls belonging to the spiritual hierarchies, angels, archangels, and so on. One knows they are there. But if people are to perceive them, they must first arouse them into what one here calls, in quotes, existence. What works on one in the spiritual world must be brought into an imagination. Unawakened being, to which humanity does nothing, it simply exists of itself, has no value in the spiritual world. Here the human being exists on the earth, surrounded by nature. However, the spiritual world requires people to lift themselves up to it, because it is not present without further activity. To have nature around us requires little. It exists, so to speak, on its own. Thus materialists love to be surrounded by nature. In the spiritual world, however, nature is no longer present. For human beings, only what they themselves work at continually is present in the spiritual world. There we must be active without interruption. What is present is the other world, the one that humans have forsaken and to which they look back continually as though to a world of existence. The world that carries the transitory within itself always battles the non-existent. If for one moment the world so beloved by the materialists were to disappear, if people knew nothing of their bodies, but first had to imagine them, if they knew nothing of a table until they had created it for themselves in thought, but could see the spiritual world instead, they would have in this life here below what they have there in the spiritual world. Those in the spiritual world can bring it to perception only through their own activity. The, quote, other world, close quote, our own world here below, is always present. Here the heaven is hidden, and only the world around us is always present. There, however, the surrounding world is hidden unless we ourselves bring it into vision by our own efforts. For those who can have immediate cognizance of it, it is easy there to believe in the world beyond, which is our present one. However, from the perspective of the spiritual, consider what makes this world disagreeable is its permeation with existence. It is a disturbing fact that it is permeated with existence. This really is disturbing. Many say that it is a spiritual world indeed, that they would willingly believe in one if they could only see it while here. We may compare such a remark with what the souls in the spiritual world say, that we might endure the physical world continually existing down there if only it were not permanently present, if only it were not so permeated with being. They cannot look down on earth without serving that terrible existence, without seeing that terrible existence in every part of it. Those who are practical materialists and do not believe in idealism love existence alone. However, so that this conviction of the only obvious manifestation does not spread, idealists always arise from time to time to lead humanity to belief in ideals and their efficacy and in the power of idealism in the progress of history. Such ideals of ethics, beauty, and religion are carried into the world. Certainly, absolute materialists will ignore them, or at most dispense with them in a few words. Nonetheless, what does not seem to exist in the material sense is carried into the physical plane as the most precious thing in life. If the evolution of humanity on the earth is considered from a higher human perspective, we may say with certainty that nature is present, grand, and significant. But what would this whole human life be if only manifest nature, be it ever so beautiful, were present? If human beings were incapable of possessing ideals, if people could not be spurred forward, not by what does not exist, but by what should exist, the ethical, religious, artistic, and educational life. It is only the unmanifest, we might say, that presses in on us from a spiritual world as the ideals of humanity. What does not exist, but should, that gives life value. Those who are not completely submerged in the swamp of materialism feel this very strongly. Therefore, those who have brought ideals throughout the course of history are in a special sense the only ones who give value to the life of manifestation through what should exist. Now the following appears to the spiritual investigator. One looks back in the same way from the spiritual world at earthly life, but in such a way that as a higher soul, one longs for everything on the earth not simply to exist, but also longs for something that is not earthly to be among the things on earth, in the strictest sense. Something else must be intermingled with earthly manifestation, that in an earthly sense has no existence. This appears as infinitely significant when a spiritual investigator perceives it in connection with those who were destined for a long life but were forcibly cut off, leaving a portion of life that, from the spiritual perspective, was really destined for existence and has not been lived out. Let us consider the case of a man who has lived in the world for only 25 or 26 years, instead of the 70 or 80 years for which he had the necessary life forces. Now let us say that he is struck by a bullet. The principles of his human nature are suddenly sundered from one another. The etheric and astral bodies and I would still have been able to develop the faculty of maintaining the physical body for quite some time. What might have continued except for the bullet was intended for the earthly existence but did not manifest. From the spiritual realm, this appears in such a way that one might say, down there is something that does not merely exist. Something else is mingled with the earthly existence, something that was destined for existence, but that has not lived through it. It is manifestation, but merely as a seed. Yet, in a sense, it is something that should exist. Therefore, those whose life is ended at an early stage in this way, through an external event, are to the spiritual world when they go through the gates of death, in a similar but not the same sense, spiritual messengers, as are the idealists who arrive on the earth to mix what should exist with the manifest. Those who go through the gates of death early ascend to announce to the heavens that on the earth there is not only mere manifestation, but also what should exist. An infinitely deep and significant discovery can be made on coming to this chapter of spiritual investigation, when one learns to know these idealists impelled to the heavens, who become what they are by going through the gates of death in the manner indicated here. And in the present time it is very fitting that we really unite such a thought with our souls. On entering the domain of spiritual life, it is necessary that besides those who, as it were, accomplish their task in the spiritual life, there should be also those who point to the earth, who have really woven something into earth's evolution, but have taken it out earlier than it should have been done, according to plan. Thus we may say that those who go early through the gates of death become in many respects, for the human souls in the spiritual world, just those who make it possible to believe in the heights of earthly life. They make it possible for those yonder to believe that earthly life really contains something spiritual that is of value, for these souls adopt a similar position there to the idealists here on earth. We must always bear in mind that we should not imagine people living on in the spiritual world as they last were when here. The trivial ideas that people hold, as for instance, that those who die as children continue to live on as children, are naturally incorrect. The imagination may picture the dead as we last saw them here, but that is not their true form. It is rather the expression of it. A child may die, but the human entity incarnated in the child may be a highly evolved soul, and continue its life after death as a highly evolved soul. I have often mentioned this. Thus we see something is carried up into the spiritual world, that being bound up with earthly existence, and nevertheless not consumed by it, should in a sense not be there, in quotes, that works in the evolution that the human soul passes through between death and rebirth. Those who have thus gone through death so pass through the intervening stage between death and rebirth that they there represent the humanity of earth in a much richer and more comprehensive sense than one can do who has gone through a normal earthly life. That has nothing to do with what is laid down for humanity through karma. If one lives to be old, that is karma. If one dies young, that is karma. But just as on earth a people cannot make themselves arbitrarily into this or that individuality, that their consciousness on this side of the veil might select, neither can they determine from earthly consciousness how the life between death and rebirth should be formed. When people are taken forcibly from physical existence into the spiritual world, they then have a much more intense imaginative vision of everything human than do those who enter the spiritual world in a different way. We say that those who pass thus through the gates of death stand especially near, during their life between death and rebirth, to what happens on earth, as far as humanity is concerned. That can be seen by investigating the lives of persons who have accomplished something of very special importance at a particular time of their life, something that perhaps only they could have done. Suppose a man accomplishes something very important in a certain way during a particular stage of his life, say at the age of 49. Of course, this can be investigated only esoterically. If we trace this back, we find that in an earlier incarnation, perhaps at the age of 49, this man died a somewhat violent death. He acquires this strong tendency toward the ideal evolution of the earth by carrying, quote, what should exist, close quote, into the spiritual world. In this way, he incorporated into his whole physical being the strong force with which to accomplish something definite in a certain year. Again, we see from this, as I pointed out in the previous lecture, that people who have to effect many things, especially through the will, and who thus live more for universal humanity, have carried such life, quote, that ought to exist, close quote, in some form from some earlier incarnation. It is indeed especially difficult to reconcile oneself to acquiring the following idea of the spiritual, if one wishes to conceive of life in the spiritual realm merely as a somewhat more refined version of earthly life. Here on earth, physical life is always obvious, whereas over there life is unknown. In the spiritual world, things are reversed. People do not take the trouble to understand that unless one takes the initiative to do something, everything is in fact dark and gloomy in the spirit life. One must first bring everything to light. Everything visible is on this side, the physical, but seen from that side. Moreover, the most significant thing intermingled there consists of, quote, something that should exist, close quote. This is a conception that you have to acquire if you wish to perceive correctly the connection between physical and spiritual life. In our time, it is really a good plan to become familiar with such concepts. As I have said, suffering souls today frequently ask themselves this: why must so many be called into the spiritual world in the flower of their youth? Why can't they complete their life here? Wonderful as it sounds, though, as I have said, spiritual truths may sometimes seem cruel, it is true, nevertheless, that the potential must be carried into the spiritual world of looking at earth in such a way that the earth itself can be permeated by the spirit. If everyone reached old age normally, if there were no martyrs, no individuals able to sacrifice themselves in youth, then the earth, regarded from above, would lapse into worthless manifestation. What is mingled here with the earth as ideal is at the same time what continually brings something better for the future from the past. This is connected with what is sacrificed here. Suppose a man of 26 sacrifices his whole future life, which he otherwise would have employed in his external work and would have devoted to the progress of humanity. This continues to live. The lives that people have sacrificed, the lives that they would have been able to live here, live in the forces of progress. Earth's evolution requires this sacrifice of life. We can see, therefore, how what is otherwise merely an abstract idea in our materialistic time becomes extremely concrete. In yet another sense than I developed it here in July, we can say that not only do these etheric bodies work in the entire connection of human progress, but the work of those who have gone early through death also lives on. The work of these individualities is such that we can ask, who then are those who principally labor for the good of humanity in general, and who set themselves universal tasks in later incarnations? They are those who have in some way or other died a death of sacrifice in earlier incarnations. The devotional natures, those given up to the spiritual here on the earth, owe this to their life of martyrdom in a previous incarnation. The earth could not progress unless people sacrificed themselves. When we think of this, we can look away from the present into the future. Such an immense number are now being sacrificed and are sacrificing themselves. Painful as this is when considered from many personal perspectives, if we look at it from the perspective of cosmic wisdom, we may console ourselves. The forces of progress will be given to the future in proportion to what is sacrificed now. Humanity requires such forces of progress. This is not considered deeply enough today, but it will be once enough decades, not centuries, have come and gone in the present materialistic evolution. The consequence of materialism will follow with incredible rapidity. The zenith of materialism was really attained in the 19th century, and humanity would be swamped by it unless something occurred to arrest it. This conversion should be brought about by spiritual science. And this can only be done by strong forces working for the ideal to be really worked into earthly life. Many who are now called away will help to prevent the earth from falling prey to materialism and being dominated by it. Just read the course of lectures on the apocalypse, in which this is indicated in broad outlines. You can then form some idea of how great is the fruit of the sacrificial deaths that will be required by earth in the future to redeem it as far as possible from sinking into materialism, and the strife, hate, and enmity connected with it, so that it can pursue its further course in the cosmos. Such a time as ours demands, more than other epochs, that we should think not only about what is taking place, but about the fruits of these happenings. And we can only recognize these fruits if we bear in mind the two sides of cosmic existence, which show us that we really experience two completely different poles of life, one here between birth and death, and the other there between death and rebirth. Here we are, in a certain sense, passive in our innermost being. And if we wish to raise ourselves to the perception of the spiritual world, we have to work so hard that many find it impossible. There it is necessary to be active in order to have with us our vision of the immediately present spiritual world in which we find ourselves. On the other hand, we also have, as a reminder, the existing world beneath. Here in this earthly world, the idealists bear, quote, what should exist, close quote, what makes existence of value. Into that world to which human beings pass through the gates of death, which those enter whose life has run its regular earthly course, come those who die more or less early as martyrs. And there they are, the witnesses that below on earth not merely the material exists, not merely what is given over to the nothingness, to the transitory and decaying, but that on earth is also intermingled, what is retained by those who did not complete their life, whose life was indeed forcibly taken from them. We must take such things not only intellectually, but unite them deeply with our feeling, and then may things become comprehensible. Certainly our present epoch contains many mysteries, but some of them can be solved if we connect the present suffering with the great wisdom of the cosmos. This again is a chapter that, if we apply what has now been said to our own times, may be embodied in the great truth, quote, from the fighter's courage, from the blood of battles, from the mourner's suffering, from the people's sacrifice, there will ripen fruits of spirit if, with consciousness, the soul turns her thought to spirit realms. Close quote. And that's the end of Lecture 3.